Black propaganda, on the other hand, is disavowed by the agency that's sponsoring it. It operates on the basis of plausible deniability, so that if something goes sour or the true goals, the true nature of the propaganda is revealed, then the actual sponsor can say, no, we didn't do that. We didn't have anything to do with that. The accusations that we had something to do with it are just completely wrong. They're a fantasy, and so on. So black propaganda involves both media operations on the one hand, persuasion, publicity, but typically it will be media that poses as opposed to the sponsor in order to discredit the side that's being attacked. Let me give you an example of how that works. Suppose you're in the middle of the Cold War. There's a radio battle, and this is actually a rather benign form, comparatively, of black propaganda. There's a radio battle between East and West, and one side or the other creates a radio station that poses as being the other side's voice, and then says outlandish, stupid, provably false, or very hostile things about the first side. Okay? Well, then the first side can use that as its own propaganda by saying, see, this is the people that we're dealing with. They're completely nuts, or they're completely corrupt, or they have no integrity, or a whole range of other types of accusations.
The false flag operation takes the concept of black propaganda to a murderous extreme. Secret agents carry out an act of terrorism or other outrage, which is then blamed on the enemy of choice. Oftentimes, false flags are perpetrated by what Lawrence Klein of the U.S. Army War College called a pseudo-team, individuals who are organized to impersonate enemy forces. Citing examples from the Hugue insurrection in the Philippines, the Mau Mau in Kenya, the French in Indochina, and other conflicts, Klein stresses their utility in intelligence gathering. But there are other, more important uses. In 1951, the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, was overthrown by the CIA and replaced by the fascist Shah. The man in charge of organizing the coup, Kermit Roosevelt, explicitly referred in his memoirs to the use of false flag operations. In the year 2000, New York Times reporter James Risen obtained a previously secret account of the coup written by CIA agent Donald Wilbur. Risen explains, in early August, the CIA, seeking to stir up anti-communist sentiment in the religious community, stepped up the pressure. Iranian operatives pretending to be communists threatened Muslim leaders with savage punishment if they opposed Mossadegh. In addition, the house of at least one prominent cleric was bombed by CIA agents posing as communists. The fact that Mossadegh was not a communist to begin with was of little concern to the plotters. The real threat was an independent Iran in control of its own oil reserves. Coinciding with the false flags, mobs were paid by the CIA to riot in the streets. In his book, CIA Diary, CIA whistleblower Philip Agee indicates that the tactics used during the coup in Iran became a matter of routine. In some cases, a timely bombing by a station agent, followed by mass demonstrations, and finally, by intervention by military leaders, in the name of the restoration of order and national unity, is a useful course. During the brutal occupation of Algeria by France, an even more elaborate pseudo-team was created. In the mid-1950s, the Direction de la Surveillance de Territoire formed a group known as the Organization of the French Algerian Resistance, or ORAF. Posing as members of the anti-colonial resistance, ORAF committed false flag bombings, targeting civilians with the aim of quashing any hopes of political compromise. Sometimes, false flag operations fail. Under Operation Susanna, in 1954, Israeli military intelligence attempted to carry out a series of false flag bombings in Egypt. The targets were to be American and British businesses, and were to be blamed on the Muslim Brotherhood. According to Israeli historian Shabtai Tevet, the assignment was to undermine Western confidence in the existing Egyptian regime by generating public insecurity and actions to bring about arrests, demonstrations, and acts of revenge while totally concealing the Israeli factor. The operation was cut short before the bloodshed could begin. Conspirator Philip Nathanson was caught attempting to detonate a bomb in a British-owned theater. Israeli Defense Minister Pinhas Levin resigned over the affair. Some false flags meet with initial success, only to create blowback at a later date. During the attempted coup in Venezuela, anti-Chavez forces intentionally fired on their own supporters, killing several people. The goal was to create the illusion of a popular uprising and government crackdown. The coup plotters, along with Bush administration spokesman Ari Fleischer, appeared on television denouncing the alleged government attacks and offering support for the coup government.
Ari Fleischer, White House spokesperson, 2002.
We know that the action encouraged by the Chavez government provoked this crisis. The Chavez government suppressed peaceful demonstrations, fired on unarmed, peaceful protesters, resulting in 10 killed and 100 wounded.
Venezuelans, the President of the Republic has betrayed the trust of his people. He's massacring innocent people with snipers. So far, 6 people have been killed and dozens wounded in Caracas. This is intolerable. We cannot accept a tyrant in the Republic of Venezuela.
It was later revealed that the military officials filmed the segment before the murders took place, exposing their actual sponsorship.
Otto Neustadt, CNN correspondent from Venezuela, 2002, reports, on the evening of the 10th, they phoned me and said, the march will go towards Miraflores Palace. There will be deaths. And 20 high-ranking officers will appear, speaking against the Chavez government and demanding the president's resignation. This proves that they were talking about deaths when there hadn't been one single death yet. It was all planned. There's a quote from 1984. In some ways, she was far more astute than Winston, and far less susceptible to party propaganda. Once, when he happened in some connection to mention the war against Eurasia, she startled him by saying casually that, in her opinion, the war was not happening. The rocket bombs which fell daily on London were probably fired by the government of Oceania itself, just to keep the people frightened. Vincenzo Vinci Guerra, former member of the neo-fascist group Ordine Nuovo. This is taken from the Alan Frankovich 1992 Time Watch program.
Gladio, così come è stata definita.
Gladio, as it's defined nowadays, forms part of what I've always referred to as parallel structures. That is, an invisible army. It's not poised for battle against a hypothetical invader, but rather one meant to be used internally, against what the military have always called the fifth column of the USSR, the Communist Party and the extreme left.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio.
Nafiz Ahmed, author of The War on Freedom.
Operation Gladio was a secret, highly classified operation that was initiated by Prime Minister Winston Churchill in around the 40s and 50s. At its inception, Churchill intended to set up a secret European-wide cell of military units that would basically be able to mobilize in response to a potential invasion of Western Europe by communist Russia. Now, these cells were actually set up with the support of the United States. NATO was the main vehicle. It was done secretly across many Western European countries. And over time, it evolved into a highly kind of disturbing form of covert action. And Operation Gladio was actually a specific operation as part of this overall process, which was taking place in Italy. What we can say for certain is that within about 10 years, this phenomenon that we saw in Operation Gladio became much more than what Churchill had originally described it was intended to be. And in the end, we had a situation where these actual cells were given the task of actually carrying out various kind of actions, including terrorist activity in different parts of Western Europe, in order to project blame onto left-wing or communist social movements.
Yet the invasion never came. In 1968, a brief for the British Chiefs of Staff noted that the Soviet Union will not deliberately start general war or even limited war in Europe, and that Soviet foreign policy has been cautious and realistic. Nevertheless, the myth of Soviet expansionism remained an important component of Cold War propaganda.
U.S. Secretary of State General Alexander Haig.
What we are watching is a four-phased operation. Phase one has been completed, the seizure of Nicaragua. Next is El Salvador, to be followed by Honduras and Guatemala. It's clear and explicit.
There is a Caribbean domino
of course.
Theory that's unfolding.
Well, I wouldn't call it necessarily a domino theory. I would call it a priority target list, a hit list, if you will, for the ultimate takeover of Central America.
In addition to justifying imperialism abroad, the myth of the international communist conspiracy would also play out domestically. In Europe, Gladio would provide the ammunition. The stay-behind networks had been supplied with massive amounts of military equipment, including explosive devices, which were stored in secret locations across the continent. In some countries, churches were used. With no Soviet army to repel, the fascists increasingly focused on what they regarded as the enemy within. False flag terror would be their primary weapon. Operation Gladio and related programs in other European nations were kept secret for decades, but eventually revealed in a series of judicial and congressional investigations in the early 1990s. In Italy, the program was closely linked to a Masonic league known as P2, or Propaganda Due. It was made up of military and intelligence officers, political leaders, industrialists, mafioso, bankers, and even Vatican contacts. Among its current members is recent Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. During his tenure as Prime Minister, Berlusconi openly expressed admiration for Mussolini and the philosophy of fascism. During the initial stages of Gladio, P2 was chaired by another avowed fascist, Lucio Gelli. A 1969 memo from Magenta Press, a fascist front group, is explicit about Gladio's tactics. Acts of terrorism will seem to have emanated from our adversaries and pressure brought to bear on people in whom power is invested at every level. That will create a feeling of hostility. At the same time, we must rise up as defender of the citizenry against the disintegration brought about by terrorism and subversion. Even more explicit was Gladio participant Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who went on the record for the BBC, stating outright the shocking mission and targets of Gladio. It was called the Strategy of Tension.
You were supposed to attack civilians, women, children, innocent people outside the political arena for one simple reason: force the Italian public to turn to the state, turn to the regime, and ask for greater security. That was precisely the role of the right in Italy. It placed itself at the service of the state, which created a strategy aptly called the Strategy of Tension, insofar as they had to get people to accept that at any moment, over a period of 30 years, from 1960 to the mid-80s, a state of emergency could be declared. So, people would willingly trade part of their freedom for the security of being able to walk the streets, go on trains, or enter a bank. This is the political logic behind all the bombings. They remain unpunished because the state cannot condemn itself.
Che rimangono impunite proprio perché lo Stato non può condannare se stesso o proclamare se stesso colpevole.
Nafis Ahmed.
It did seem to be the case that, for the most part, civilian governments were not aware of the nature of these operations going on and were completely shocked when they discovered that you had CIA and MI6, through NATO, effectively infiltrating their own intelligence services and operating autonomous subsections of these agencies in order to carry out these kind of operations. In most cases, we did find, however, that there were specific members of the civilian government who were aware. Either it could have been a defence minister, for example, it might have been the prime minister alone, but it varied from case to case.
One of the first major bombings in Italy occurred on December 12, 1969. At the Banca Nazionale dell'Agricoltura. 16 people were killed and another 88 wounded when fascists detonated an explosive device. An anarchist named Giuseppe Pinelli was blamed. He took the fall for the bombing, literally, when police threw him out of the window of a local precinct.
Bologna Railway Station, December 12, 1969. Gladio units detonate a massive bomb, killing 85 people and wounding 200. The bombing is blamed on socialists. But the Italian Senate later concludes that it had been conducted by, quote, men inside Italian state institutions, linked to the structures of United States intelligence, unquote.
In Belgium, the machine gun became the weapon of choice. In the mid-1980s, masked terrorists began strolling into supermarkets and opening fire on men, women, and children.
He saw three masked men coming out at the rear. He said to his child, "Drop down, there they are." One bystander who tried to flee was shot at. Seven or eight bullets through his car, and a shot grazing behind the ear. One woman, whose face was covered in blood, was screaming something about her child.
Described in the press as the supermarket massacres, they were linked by the Belgian parliament to their Gladio unit. It was later suggested that one of the aims of the supermarket massacres was to encourage a right-wing government that would be more amenable to accepting U.S. proposals for stationing nuclear-tipped missiles in Belgium.
The dinner was ready and we were waiting for my daughter and my son-in-law and their two children. Saturday was our family day. All of a sudden I heard shooting from the Delhaize supermarket. We ran out to the terrace and my wife screamed, "My children." I said, "Calm down, I will have a look at what happened." The doors to the supermarket were wide open and a crowd was pushing out. I wanted to go in, against the tide, but people were saying, "Don't, people have been shot in there." Then they told me that my whole family had been shot.
The strategy of tension was a Europe-wide enterprise.
The first stage was to make attacks which would be blamed on the left. The second stage was actual infiltration of groups on the left, including these extra-parliamentary groups to carry out attacks. These groups were instrumental in increasing the social and political tension in the country.
The first one was to organize gangs to do hold-up, hostage, you know, and killing. The second one was to organize a so-called left movement who will do a terrorist attempt, just to make the population believe that these terrorist attempts were done by the left.
In some of these cases, you had situations where you had local left-wing groups who had emerged organically on the basis of perfectly normal domestic kind of dynamics and were infiltrated and manipulated by intelligence agencies to instigate these acts of propagation and to take the blame. So that gives you an example where organic forms of political movements, whether or not they're involved in terrorism at the beginning, can be infiltrated, manipulated, mobilized by states to carry out this kind of activity. And there are many, many examples from the historical record.
On March 16th, 1978, Italy's former Prime Minister Aldo Moro was kidnapped in a sophisticated military-style operation. His three bodyguards were killed during the assault. The attacks were blamed on the Red Brigades, a militant communist group. Moro had been attempting to create a power-sharing arrangement by which the Italian Communist Party would be allowed to participate in operations of government with the Christian Democrats. His compromise was fiercely opposed by the United States. According to Moro's widow, he was told at a meeting with Henry Kissinger that, quote, "You must abandon your policy of bringing all the political forces in your country into direct collaboration, or you will pay dearly for it," unquote. Moro was murdered shortly after his kidnapping. It remains unknown how many terrorist outrages performed during the Cold War were staged or provocateured by intelligence assets posing as leftists or other political groups. In 1971, at the height of the strategy of tension, the Bern Club was formed. It was made up of the intelligence services of the 27 states of what now constitutes the European Union, as well as Norway, Switzerland, and the United States. It exists to this day.
We had basically waves of terrorist bombings and atrocities carried out in Turkey, in Italy, in Greece, in Spain, in many parts of Western Europe. And in all of these cases, we have strong evidence that these instances were actually mobilised by these secret cells that were co-opted by NATO. What actually did happen subsequently is that the civilian governments of these countries did respond to these atrocities, believing them to have been conducted by left-wing groups. And it did create a massive kind of drive against left-wing movements to encroach on civil liberties, to really kind of conduct very draconian policies, both at home and abroad. What we learned from Operation Gladio is that intelligence and covert action as carried out by states is clearly something which is routinely conducted under the radar, and that it's often conducted in such a way that civilian administrations are not fully aware of what is going on. And to be honest with you, I think this is not really something controversial. I mean, anyone who has genuinely studied covert operations and the nature and structure of intelligence agencies will be aware that the whole point of covert action is precisely to conceal it from public awareness. The danger of it is clearly that when you have a case like Operation Gladio or the strategy of tension documented during the Cold War, this really reveals how far intelligence agencies are able to go as a consequence of that. And that raises a lot of disturbing questions about really the scope of the intelligence agencies and their capacity to conduct very, very dangerous covert action, which is not in the interests of the wider public, which is not in the national interest, and which violates even the basic kind of rule of law that is established by the civilian government.
A quote from Sun Tzu: all war is based on deception.
False flag operations have not only been used to demonize dissidents and topple governments, they have also been used as sparks to ignite world wars. In 1931, the Japanese blew up several stretches of their own railroads in the Chinese region of Manchuria. The attacks were blamed on Chinese rebels, providing a pretext for the Japanese to invade. Similarly, in 1939, the Nazis faked an attack on a German radio station in Gleiwitz.
Polnische Aufständischen Verband! Jeder Widerstand ist zwecklos und wird sofort gebrochen. Wer sich uns in den Weg stellt, Skinje, wird niedergeschlagen.
They took a concentration camp victim, dressed him in a Polish army uniform, then left his body at the crime scene in order to implicate the Polish government. In this case, the result was nothing less than World War II. False flags are not necessary to start wars, but they serve an important function. They allow the aggressor state to portray itself as the victim, while rallying public opinion behind the war effort.
I thought I'd break the video at this point, give us another angle on this formula. This is the soundtrack of a video about the 1999 Russian apartment bombings. I'm not sure who the speaker is or when it was recorded, but it was published in December 2012 on YouTube by a user who refers in their username to the Institute for the Study of Globalization and Covert Politics, and I'll publish a link to their YouTube channel from this show's webpage.
Yeltsin's popularity at that point had reached 2%. The rating was 2%. And pollsters explained that, in fact, in any poll, 6% of the people don't understand the question. So it was real doubt as to whether anyone in Russia actually backed Yeltsin. A similar poll about his newly appointed prime minister, after the brilliant operation with Yuri Skuratov, Vladimir Putin, showed that 2% of the population was willing to vote for Putin. I was in Moscow at the time. There was reported to be panic in the Russian leadership about what might happen. It began to be circulate rumors, very ominous rumors, that there were going to be terrorist attacks, that they would be blamed on someone, they would be used to impose a state of emergency, or to pull off something else. The bombings took place in the middle of the night to inflict maximum casualties and to terrorize the whole country. And the leadership said that there was a Chechen trail, not Chechen proof, not proof of Chechen bomb. Up until that time, there was no enthusiasm in Russia for a new Chechen war. But in the wake of these bombings, which seemed to be directed against the Russian people themselves, the country united. They supported overwhelmingly a new war in Chechnya. That war resulted in initial successes.
The main trump card of the presidential campaign is the successful operation in Chechnya.
And it elevated the popularity rating of the previously unknown head of the FSB, Putin, to unheard of levels.
The military operation in Chechnya is going well. Air and artillery strikes are reaching maximum effect. The military are saying that nobody can stop them now.
And in fact, no questions would have been raised about this sequence of events. However strange it may seem, had it not been for one mistake.
On Wednesday evening, inhabitants of an apartment building in Ryazan alerted the police to the presence of a suspicious car at the entrance. A police unit discovered three sacks filled with a substance containing hexogen.
A bomb was placed in the basement of a building in Ryazan, and the bombers were seen. And a quick-thinking resident of the building in Ryazan called the police.
Independent Investigation, an NTV show from March 24th, 2000. I was the one who met the policeman downstairs. Their attitude was at first rather lax, as they were constantly being called out on false alarms by worried residents. So they went down into the basement. But when they came out, their attitude was very different.
As they saw that there was a bomb with a detonator and a timer underneath, you know, attached to the main supports of the building, they ran out, evacuated the building, evacuated, you know, the surrounding buildings, and then evacuated the entire district.
At about 10 o'clock, policemen started banging on people's doors, ordering everybody to get out. After what happened in Moscow, people ran out in their slippers and bathrobes. Ryazan police have been on red alert all day, hunting the terrorists who last night planted a powerful explosive in the basement of a building in Novozelov Street. The cordons on the city exits have been reinforced by customs units and paratroopers. So far, nobody has been detained. It would seem the terrorists left the city immediately. The Interior Minister, Vladimir Rushagto, proudly announced the successful thwarting of the terrorist attack. The evidence of an improvement in our work is the prevention of the explosion at a building in Ryazan.
And shortly afterward, with the city in a state of siege, the railroad stations blocked, the airport blocked, a telephone call was made from a public telephone, and an attentive telephone operator decided to listen in on the conversation.
A voice asks, "Is the lady with you?" The lady is taking a trolley bus at 12. Where's the car? In the parking lot. Split up and leave Ryazan separately. Patrols are everywhere. At this point, it was clear I was listening to terrorists.
The local police, not being wise to what was going on, traced the number, thought that they would get the number of the Chechen terrorists who had organized this. And to their astonishment, the number turned out to be the number of the FSB. A short time later, the three perpetrators of this act were arrested and presented FSB documents. And the FSB quickly intervened and demanded their release. It was now clear that the FSB could not remain silent, that they had to come up with some kind of explanation.
There wasn't an explosion, first of all. Secondly, it wasn't prevented. Well, our people weren't quite spot on. It was an exercise, and there was sugar in the sacks, not explosives. The television host asked the audience on the Independent Investigation program, "What's your comment on this announcement?" As of today, the investigation is practically completed, and the television host interrupts him and asks, "What crime are you investigating?" "The one which we've been investigating from the very start." "At which one?" "Terrorism. Conspiracy to enact a terrorist plot." A member of the audience asks, "The FSB initiated this criminal case. Is this an FSB case against itself?" "The case was instigated on account of a fact, of the discovery of..." He's interrupted again to ask, "How can you explain the fact that even the Interior Ministry only found out about the exercise 48 hours after its beginning? Why the delay? 48 hours? Well, you know, there might have been some shortcomings. We asked you to let us talk to the people who planted those sacks. Where are they? Where is the car? Well, it works like this. During exercises, we use all our available means and forces. Another member of the audience, once again, they're making fools of us. An FSB exercise is being investigated by the FSB itself. We can be certain they will quietly close the case. It's terrifying to say this, but I think everything was for real. No exercise was taking place. And the host asks the other guests in the studio, other residents that night, do you think this was an exercise? And nobody says it was an exercise, bringing up points such as, why was nobody told at the time? Why did it take 2 days? Or, I've run exercises, I'm a military man, I know what exercises look like, and this wasn't it. Their uniform in their charging of the FSB, saying, no, this wasn't an exercise, this was a cover-up.
Various people have said to me that, well, you haven't proven it, I mean, you can't prove it. And I said, this is a little bit of a perversion of the venerable Anglo-Saxon doctrine of presumption of innocence. Presumption of innocence is intended to protect the individual against the government. It doesn't apply to a government which is suspected of a mass crime against its own population. We have a typical kind of KGB-FSB government in Russia.
And we return to the earlier discussion of false flag operations.
In fact, they needn't even involve real physical events. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which it was alleged that North Vietnamese forces attacked an American naval vessel, was entirely fictitious.
Shortly after noon, the calm of the day is broken as General Porter sounds. In a deliberate and unprovoked action, three North Vietnam PT boats unleash a torpedo attack against the Manning.
The destroyer was carrying out a mission of patrol in those waters, in international waters, when it was attacked.
Senator William Fulbright.
Well, I think it's a very clear demonstration of the unity of the country behind the policies that are being followed by the president in South Vietnam, and more specifically of the action that was taken in response to the attack upon our destroyers.
The Tonkin incident never happened, yet it allowed for a vast expansion of the American war effort in Vietnam.
James Petrus, Professor Emeritus, Binghamton University.
These kinds of operations, they're effective in the short run, particularly because all the information comes from the U.S. government, and secondly, the media is so submissive to relay whatever the government says happened rather than investigate in greater depth the circumstances surrounding these false flag operations. So they're successful to the degree in which they monopolize the government and the mass media conform to the message which has been sent out.
In light of the immense historical consequences of false flag operations, one might assume that they would be the subject of continual and extensive study by journalists and scholars. Yet, if anything, the opposite is true. False flags remain one of the biggest taboos in journalism. In order to sidestep the issue, and deep politics as a whole, many journalists and academics have created a workaround. They call it conspiracy theory.
How much would you attribute the increase in conspiratorial thinking to that red line?
There has been an explosion of conspiracy theories flying fast and furious over the internet.
Those conspiracy people,
a lot of the conspiracy theories, of course 9/11 conspiracy theory goes back to the Bush era.
Conspiracy mongering.
Fringe conspiracy theorists.
The people who foment conspiracy theories, crazy conspiracy theories, full-blown American conspiracy theories are a great American pastime. And not all of them are on the right. There's plenty on the left as well.
Never told a soul about it. In fact, they engage in a vast conspiracy.
You get accused of being a conspiracy theorist, speculation, conspiracy theories.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
Painting this type of picture
only feeds the delusions of those who wear tinfoil hats around their house.
You know, there have always been crazy people who gravitate, if they have schizophrenia, who gravitate toward conspiracy theories.
Those true believers in the mystic power of New Age crystals, spirit channeling, of people who talk to trees.
Now, I don't consider myself a conspiracy buff at all, but when they get a lot of coincidences, I get a little suspicious.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
How does this term conspiracy theory get used, and what are the purposes that it's used for? Conspiracy theory is a little bit like the word propaganda, and it's used specifically to discredit someone and to say, in effect, you're nuts, you're making it up, or you don't know you don't have knowledge about this, or that you're irrational. That's the description of a conspiracy theory. So that is a very effective way and frequently used in the mass media and by media commentators and reporters as a means of discrediting points of view that they don't agree with.
Michael Parenti, historian.
Conspiracy theory is a term that's used whenever anybody ascribes conscious intent to people with power. So I can say to you that school teachers are concerned about their salaries, and they're organizing, and they're threatening a strike, and they're pressuring. I can say to you that farmers are doing this and looking for subsidies and facing certain policies. But the minute I say to you that the very people at the top, the plutocracy, the very rich and powerful, the ones who own most of America, that they are consciously pursuing power and wealth, someone will come along and say, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? Or they'll say, oh, you're cynical or you're paranoid. Their view is that stuff just happens. Things just happen, unintended consequences, or our leaders are stupid and they're jerks, or they're confused and they don't know any better. And, of course, the critic knows much better than everybody else. People who operate in this world operate with intent. There's no such thing as imperialism without imperialists. There's no such thing as capitalism without capitalists. There's no such thing as rulers who are somnambulists who walk around in their sleep. You watch out for your interests. You watch out and you make calculations. What makes you think that David Rockefeller doesn't? What makes you think that the people at the top don't do it? And what makes you think they don't collude and organize? Or what do you think? You have a group of people who sit around in a room and they plan this? And I always say, oh no, God, they don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they go up and down merry-go-rounds, or they meet skydiving and they hold hands and they argue. Of course they sit in rooms. Where the hell else are they going to meet?
Popular usage of the term conspiracy theory does not appear to closely correlate with evidence in support of a particular assertion. British Prime Minister Tony Blair dismissed the idea that the invasion of Iraq may have been motivated by oil as an absurd conspiracy theory. In fact, the most absurd conspiracy theories are often promoted by the most powerful individuals in society, including Tony Blair himself. His claim that Iraq had retained massive amounts of chemical and biological weapons and was plotting with Al-Qaeda to attack the West had zero evidentiary support. The Third Reich promoted the conspiracy theory that Jews were responsible for most of the world's ills. During the Cold War, American policy planners claimed that the Kremlin was engaged in a worldwide communist conspiracy, even while their own intelligence reports suggested the opposite. More recently, Muslims have become the primary scapegoat. In 2008, the John McCain presidential campaign mailed out 28 million copies of the pseudo-documentary Obsession, a hate film suggesting that Muslims are engaged in a massive conspiracy to create a worldwide Islamic dictatorship. On the populist right, macro-conspiracy theories are often used to deflect attention from class analysis while encouraging scapegoating.
These are the big players in the world right now on the things that are happening. Big education,
is fundamentally involved in everything that is happening. Soros, the Tides Foundation, Open Society. Anonymous is now starting to take a big role. SEIU and AFL-CIO. Russia and Putin is now in control. I remember I said that about 8 years ago. And I said, Putin's going to come roaring back. Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, really. Here's Occupy Wall Street, Islamic extremism, Iran, the White House, and the media. These are all the real players that are causing so many problems right now.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
What's a conspiracy? Is everything that somebody says happened? Does that mean that that's actually happened? Some of the stuff that people believe about the CIA or the National Security State or Jews or black people or Wall Street or, you know, you name it, liberal media, right-wing media. Some of the things that people believe about, all of those controversial things, are not true. And so we get into a situation in which the accusation that a conspiracy exists or that there's a plan afoot to do something becomes a powerful political tool. One of the most powerful tools of propaganda is rumors, rumor mongering. And one can see it even in elections, you can see it in international affairs and so forth. Rumors appeal to people's primal fears, fears about race, fears about gender, fears about their own relationship between themselves and authority, those sorts of things. And there are plenty of people out there who will exploit those fears. And it's quite difficult for ordinary people who are living their lives to card out what is just nonsense from what is incredible yet real. There's no simple solution to this problem. Present-day media tends to encourage people to believe in nonsense by giving credibility to it on the one hand, and on the other hand, oftentimes, not always, denying the reality of evidence that is substantial. I think that the way to get at this in a social sense is to keep an open mind, investigate carefully, and not to believe in stuff that you don't understand. We as scholars, teachers, media people, just as ordinary citizens, should not propagate stuff that they don't understand or that they don't have factual support for.
Russ Baker, journalist.
You know, the term conspiracy theory is a very interesting one. It is, of course, applied to almost anything that's perceived as threatening, any kind of broader attempt to explain specific events. There certainly are people and elements out there that create these explanations for everything, and those are potentially dangerous because they do lead to scapegoating. On the other hand, there are actual people, actual covert operations, actual things happening that we don't know about, and it's very, very important to understand them. I mean, they are fundamentally conspiracies, which simply means several people colluding in a secret and illegal operation. Conspiracies are prosecuted every day in the courtrooms of this country, and theory is what we use to try to understand things. So I find the term conspiracy theory a broad brush pejorative, which I think is designed to suppress discussion. I do think we need to distinguish between those who see a bogeyman everywhere and those who do careful research and come to the conclusion in particular cases that there was some sort of an organized effort to do something, perhaps to remove a president or to achieve some other change of which the public was never informed.
If you're going to look and say, you know, it's structures and systems that run the world, you have to realize that there are trap doors in these structures and systems, and that not all of the structure, not all of the system is visible in the public record. And that's where we come back to what I say about deep politics and a deep state. We have to acknowledge that there are processes going on
that are not finding their way straight away into newspapers and history books. And it's so interesting that America can see that about other countries, just has problems seeing it about itself.
And that concludes part 3, The Strategy of Tension. I suspect we shall finish the series next week with parts 4 and 5. There's just time to play you the following section by Mark Crispin Miller. We broadcast this on the show 2 years ago from episode 561, $100 million to crack a lone nut. That was the first show we made about Gladio. So I shall link to it from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/659. This is from the introduction to the Investigate Building 7 conference at the University of Hartford in March this year.
I think it's abundantly clear that the NIST study leaves a lot to be desired, and that there's copious and specific evidence that the official explanation for 9/11 in general, and Building 7 in particular, is it strains credulity. But the question is, how come when there's so much evidence that cries out for a new investigation, which after all is what we want, how come when there's so much evidence, there seems to be no journalistic response? There's no reporting on this important story. In fact, the more evidence there is, it seems, the less likely any kind of coverage, the more resistant journalists tend to become, and that's not just mainstream journalists, but even on the left as well. Well, there's nothing really particularly unusual about this problem. In other words, the journalistic silence on the vast body of evidence vis-a-vis Building 7, for example, is not unusual. It's something that we've seen repeatedly over the last 50 or 60 years. The reason why you get no journalistic hearing despite all that evidence is that this notion that the official report is faulty is a conspiracy theory, right? And you are all conspiracy theorists, and you've heard a lot of conspiracy theory here. That's the phrase you run into again and again and again and again. So this is the problem that the panel's going to discuss, and I'm going to introduce the other panelists as soon as I make just a couple of very basic points, and they don't require any background in engineering, okay? I think the engineers here will enjoy them, however. Or appreciate them, I should say. First of all, the idea that there might be some kind of an elite conspiracy was once upon a time in this nation's history a given. I mean, if you read widely in the work of the framers, you see that the possibility that their young Republican experiment might be undone by an elite conspiracy. It was always on their minds. They were preoccupied with this, that the British Empire and its agents and its sympathizers in the United States might do everything they could conspiratorially to destroy this experiment in Republican self-government. This is, you know, just read what they had to say about Aaron Burr, for example. Elite conspiracy was not a crackpot idea, you see, but common sense. So it's important to understand that, that this allergy that we have all developed to anything that smacks of conspiracy theory, where we make the sign of the cross and hold ourselves away, you know, this is fairly recent. And it is particularly germane, I think, to note that it was not commonplace in journalistic discourse until the late 60s. It was not until some authors began to question the findings of the Warren Commission that journalists began to use the phrase conspiracy theory. I should say that the phrase conspiracy theory became current, and it really never stopped being current. We've seen it repeatedly ever since, particularly from 1980 on. And I can suggest that you dig up a declassified CIA memo from April 1st, 1967 that deals with the problem of these authors. This is Mark Lane and Edward J. Epstein had written books questioning the results of the Warren Commission. The CIA said this is a problem. Our solution is to use our, this is a quote, propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by using the following five arguments. You know, and then there are arguments we keep hearing today, like if there were such a big conspiracy, someone would have talked, something like that. The point is that there it is, it's in black and white, it's the CIA suggesting that the media be used to cast aspersions on what were, after all, entirely reasonable questions about the official explanation of the Kennedy assassination. Okay? Well, if you search the phrase conspiracy theory in the archives of the New York Times or Time magazine, it'll take you a few seconds, you see that before the late 60s, the phrase was very, very rarely used. And then after the late 60s, it's used again and again and again and again. I would suggest that if you want to get anywhere with this issue, okay, you cannot keep simply trying to push the evidence on journalists. At the same time, you have to raise a more fundamental question, which is, what do we mean when we say something's a conspiracy theory, right? And why is it self-evident that conspiracies are impossible? Conspiracies against democracy. Why are they any more unlikely now than they were back in 1787? Okay? So the fact is, there have been many stories since the 60s that have been treated in exactly this way. Stories in which the evidence is overwhelming, which the case has actually been made, and yet somehow that story gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. I don't need to see the evidence. I know it's a conspiracy theory because it's unlikely, because it's something I'd rather not believe.
Darkness and midnight, but the pot-belly thieves chase their unwelcome guests.
This episode was made possible by the good work of Scott Noble in producing that documentary and his assistants at Metanoia Films. If you'd like to see more of their material, you can do so from metanoia-films.org, and I'll link that in from this show's webpage. Thanks too to Olivier, who drew my attention to this film. This show would not be the show it is without an army of listeners out there sending me pointers to material and sometimes helping to read audiobooks, to adapt videos, or to otherwise contribute to the show. If you would like to help making a show, then there's a mailing list you can join, accessible at altruists.org/unwelcome, or you can just give me an email, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. As well as the mailing list, there's a Twitter feed, twitter.com/unwelcomeguests, which announces the new episodes. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Understand this show's material, as last week has been dark. I hope it inspires you in your own visions and plans for a lighter, brighter world, one in which truth is embraced rather than suppressed.
But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take these poor